So, good morning, everyone. Welcome. We are going to pick up where we left off last time, which was in the middle of Old English. So, we'll start by briefly recapping the morphology and what you need to know for the morphology for Old English. We'll talk about the syntax today, about the lexicon of the language and the dialect. In other words, we're going to round off Old English today by talking about all of the aspects that we didn't talk about last time, as well as a little bit of revision of what we talked about last time. So, just a quick reminder, there's a tutorial today. It's in the usual time at the usual place, two tutorials, in fact, and there is one on Friday as well. So, what we covered last time was essentially a lot of sound changes, but also a lot of morphology. And the morphology is really important because Old English differs from Modern English the most, probably in precisely this domain. We've got a full case system, we've got verbs inflecting robustly for person and number, and we've got strong versus weak verbs, both of which are robust classes with generalizations to be made about them. Now, some of these properties still hold in Modern English to some extent. There is still a nominative-accusative case distinction, or at least there is still a case distinction among pronouns. So he versus him, I versus me. There is a case distinction there, but it's all that's left of this system that once extended to demonstratives, to adjectives, to nouns, all over the place. Similarly, the verbs inflecting, well, we've still got that useful third-person singular S, that still enters into the picture in Modern English, but it's the only bit that's left of a once much more robust system for doing this. And with the strong and weak verbs, there are many more strong verbs in Old English, and they're much more systematic in their behavior. Now, this is the kind of thing that I gave you last week, a paradigm. This is the one with the demonstratives. Several people have asked me what I expect you to know about these paradigms. And that is a really important question, because what I don't want you to do is learn all of these paradigms off by heart. You can do that if you want to, but honestly, the day will never come when you are in a life or death situation and the only way to escape will be through your deep knowledge of Old English morphology. What I do want you to know, because you're students of English and students of the history of English, is how this system works and how to use these paradigms and how to use this knowledge that you've acquired. So, for instance, if you find a form that you think is going to be a weak adjective, you should know how to look it up. If you have a form, how you can cross-reference it with the paradigms to figure out what you need. You need to know things about the system of the language to do that. You need to know in what circumstances strong adjectives occur, in what circumstances weak adjectives occur. You need to know in what circumstances your demonstrative will inflect. That kind of thing is the crucial knowledge for this course. Because, for instance, the exam for this course, you will get the paradigms that you need. You will receive the paradigms, but you will not have much time, and you will need to be able to do things with these paradigms, okay? So if you're constantly, if you get a word form and you have absolutely no idea what it is, then the task is to figure out what it is and what it's doing there, and how you know. And for that, you will need a bit of knowledge of the basics of this structure. And it's useful then to know some basic generalizations about the paradigms. So for instance, that this M ending is something that's quite common in the dative case, for instance. The large-scale generalizations, that's what's useful to know, not all of the fine detail. Does that make sense? These kind of generalizations. A similar one here, in the neuter, the nominative and the accusative are always the same. That's useful to know as well. I probably won't be so mean as to ask you to identify a case form that you can't possibly distinguish, but it's still useful to have that general knowledge about how the system functions. So that's the kind of level of detail I would expect you to get to with these kind of paradigms. And that's the sort of thing I'm going to be asking you about on the exam. Here's this word, what is it? What's it doing? What are its grammatical features? And you won't have to do that from scratch. You'll have the paradigms there to help you, but you'll need to know what to do with them. Does anyone have any questions? No? All right. Well, one thing that will have struck you last week is that we talked quite a lot about these forms, about the generalizations to be made regarding the structure of these paradigms, but what we didn't talk about was what these paradigms, what these things were actually used for. Now, since a lot of you are native speakers of German, or learners of German, you will know something about how these cases are used in general anyway, because the system as a whole is rather similar. But it's still worth bringing this out explicitly, because this is something that needs to be understood explicitly, and not just as a part of implicit linguistic knowledge. So the basic functions, and actually the cases have a lot of functions. The basic functions are the ones given here, particularly the bold underlined ones. So you find the nominative case on the subject of a clause. That is the basic generalization for where you're most likely to find a nominative. That's the sort of the big picture thing here. Subject is not the doing... It's subject. Sometimes it's said that the subject is the agent, the subject's doing something. That's not entirely accurate. The subject is a grammatical notion. The subject is what the verb agrees with. And the subject, therefore, in a clause like I gave him John's book, it's I. In Old English or a language like German, it's even clearer because there's actually more agreement to tell you what the subject is. That's what the nominative case is used for, more than anything else. So in a sentence like, I gave him John's book, this I is the subject. The reason why the correlation, by the way, between subject and agent doesn't hold up is that there are examples like... I slept, or I arrived, or I fell over, where you're not really doing anything. There's no agentivity involved. It's rather something that happens to you. So that's the nominative case. The other use of the nominative case is in certain constructions where a language like Latin or Sanskrit would use what's called a vocative. If that doesn't mean anything to you, what I mean by this is when you address something or someone directly. So a language, so if I know that Christoph is down here at the front and I say Christoph, then in Latin or Sanskrit I would use the vocative case. In English we don't have cases on nouns, so it doesn't make any difference. Proper names in German don't do anything, so that doesn't make any difference either. If you ever get a case like this, then in Old English, you will find the nominative case in this kind of example. So when something is being addressed directly, this is a vocative use of the nominative. And that's what we find that's another use of the nominative in Old English. What about the accusative then? Well, the accusative is used for the direct object of the clause. So here in example, I gave him John's book, the bit that would be accusative marked, if English were a case marking language, would be John's book. Specifically, book, because John's has a different case, as we'll see in a second. So accusative is the one that's found on the direct object of the clause. And it's also found on the complement of some prepositions. For instance... motion verbs, motion prepositions. Now, an interesting fact here is, just like in German, there are prepositions that allow you to have the accusative case or the dative case, depending on whether you're dealing with motion or location. And if it's motion, you get the accusative case, and if it's location, then you get the dative case. So this is like, for instance, in die Schule versus in der Schule. Okay, one of them is into the school. In English, you translate it as into, and the other is in location, no movement. So that's the clear. That's the sort of generalization. In Old English, there are a bunch of prepositions that behave like this. Not all of them, but some of them do. And typically, if you have a preposition of motion, typically it will be followed by the accusative case. So prepositions specify what case you get after them, and this is in motion cases, it's the accusative. Dative case then. The dative case is the indirect object. The indirect object is often, but not always, the recipient. So here you've got a recipient construction in English, and him would be in the dative case in Old English or in German. Now, what's important to note here is that the in English, in modern English, there is no distinction between dative and accusative case anywhere, even in pronouns. So him can be either a direct object or an indirect object. And which it is depends on the word order. This is one of the reflexes, remember, of Old English being a more synthetic language, relies more on its case endings, versus modern English, a more analytic language, relies more on its word order. But in this case, like I gave him John's book, the indirect object is him. And in Old English, in an Old English example, you would find him as in the dative case. In fact, this particular form is the dative pronoun form from Old English, masculine dative. Does anyone remember what the accusative form is? It's something slightly different. It's hinne, H-I-N-E. So in Old English, there is this distinction between the dative and the accusative, very parallel to the modern German distinction between ihn and ihm. Okay? Now, the final case that we have to deal with is the genitive, and the genitive is usually found on possessors. And this is the case also in Old English. So in a sentence like, I gave him John's book, John's would be genitive in Old English. Now, you have to be careful with the genitive because modern English has an S ending, but this modern English S ending isn't really a case ending. It doesn't really behave like case endings do. Because remember that case endings in a case language attach to all kinds of things. You find them on adjectives, you find different forms of the determiner, you find different forms of nouns, pronouns, but in the genitive case in English, insofar as you can call it a case, it really is just this S. And the apostrophe here does actually mean something to a certain extent. If it stands for anything, you can think of it standing for the fact that this S doesn't actually attach to words. It attaches to the edge of a phrase. What do I mean by that? Well, look at this. The only thing, so here, John's is marked with an S. In an example like the man's, it's the word man that's marked with an S. That's all well and good. And so you can see that, you know, the last word in the phrase always has the S on it. But so far, it's always the noun. But it doesn't have to be the noun. You can say something like, the man I gave the book to's house, right? Where the S attaches to the end to a preposition in a relative clause right at the end. Something like... the computer on the table's socket. Right. The S attaches to table, not to computer, even though it's the computer that the socket belongs to. So this S in modern English is not a case ending. It's actually it's the most straightforward way of characterizing it as something called a clitic. It's halfway between an independent word and an affix. And it attaches here to the end of the phrase, the end of the possessive phrase. That's the modern English genitive. The Old English genitive is different. The Old English genitive behaves like any other case. You've got the whole phrase, and it's the whole phrase is genitive marked. So that's interesting. So that means that sometime in the history of English, a massive, massive change has taken place. This S, the way it functions, is completely different now. It's no longer a case ending. In fact, it's something else. It's a clitic, a possessive clitic. Okay, these are just the basic functions of the case endings. There are others, and the cases do other things too, but I'm not going to bore you with all of them because the ones that it's important to know about are these ones: subject, direct object, indirect object, possessor. And those you can more or less map on to the cases that you find. The instrumental, if you ever find the instrumental, that's easy because it just is used for instruments. But the instrumental case, the mysterious fifth case of Old English, is mostly not found at all. It is very much on the decline, on the way out, by the time of the texts that we have. And there are various textbooks or basic grammars of Old English, also online resources that you can use to find out about the cases some more. But let's look at some examples now. So this is an early West Saxon text. Remember that these are the texts associated with King Alfred's court. It was once thought that King Alfred himself translated this text, the Orosius. Most people don't believe that anymore, but it was certainly someone associated with him. And this is a text about a man called Othere, who traveled to the north. He traveled to present-day Scandinavia, and then he came and reported back. So we start off with Othere Sade, his Hlaforde, Alfrede Kuninge. There are E's here. The end of the word, E's. These are singular dative marked E's. Why are there E's here? Why are there dative endings? Well, because this is an indirect object. It's the recipient, right? You say something to someone else. And so you've got this indirect object here. His lord, Alfred, king. Remember, this shows another property of Old English. No definite article, no necessary definite article here. Here we've got Alfred King, not Alfred the King, or anything like that. Also not King Alfred, which is what we'd expect in the present day language. So this is a dative marked indirect object. And those E's on the end of nouns are a good indication. It's not foolproof. It's clearly not foolproof because you can see there's an E on the end of this name, Othere. And that's not in the dative case. But if you see an E on the end of a noun, a good guess at a first attempt would be that it is a dative singular noun. And then we find, so he said to his lord Alfred the king, that he, and here he, is just the same he we have in modern English. Nominative case is the subject. Eadra Northmonna, of all Northmen. This is a genitive. It's an of. You could paraphrase it in modern English with an of. That usually means that we're dealing with a genitive. So, of all Northmen, and here you've got distinctive genitive endings. This a ending is a genitive plural ending in this context. And if you look up the forms, that is one of the things that you will find. So of all of the north men, he lived the northmost. Right. So here, aðr norðmanna norðmest búðu. Again, we've got a he, and he, nice and simple, subject. He quað, he said. Now this verb, interestingly, quæðan, we don't have it in modern English anymore, but you do see it in some quite late texts. So for instance, if you are familiar with Edgar Allan Poe, you might know the line, quoth the raven, nevermore. And quoth is the same word as quá here. He said. So quoth is something that you find. You also find it a lot in the Bible, the King James Bible translation. So this is the special verb for to say. It alternates with the other verb, seyan, to say, that you will find in the Old English texts. And they're both roughly equally frequent in the Old English texts. So, quæðan and seyan, he quæð, that he, another he, lived in on them lande, auf dem land, okay? Except that that's not quite that, semantically. But the form is on them lande. Another dative ending, an e, right? And the E, and because of the way the Old English system is set up, an E is a little bit more unambiguous as a case ending than it is in a language like German. So this E here indicates very strongly that you're dealing with a dative form, but what really gives it away, what makes it absolutely certain that you're dealing with a dative, is this demonstrative here, tham. Remember that I told you last week, the demonstrative, if you're trying to identify what case something is, the demonstrative is the most useful thing, because the demonstrative is very, very distinctly inflected for lots of different forms. We can flip back to here, and you can see all of the different distinct demonstrative forms. So if you're trying to figure out what case something is in Old English, the most straightforward way of doing it is using exactly this demonstrative pronoun. You don't always find a demonstrative. Sometimes you're not lucky enough to find a demonstrative, but when you do have it, it's really good evidence if you're trying to figure out a case form. So Ochter said to his lord Alfred that he lived the northmost of all northmen. He said that he lived in the land northwards, northwärdum, along with. So this is an interesting one. The preposition with, you have it in Old English, but it means something different. It means against or along. So if you see with, then it means against or along. So he lived against or along Thawestse, the West Sea. And here again, you've got a demonstrative. This is a demonstrative that's a little bit more ambiguous in its form. But if you know that something is singular, so we know here, for instance, that Westse is singular, is a sea. Right. If we know that, then we can look and see, where do we find this tha in the singular? Well, in the plural, we find it all over the place. We find it up here. But in the singular, there's only one place we find it, and that's here, feminine accusative. So if you got the pieces of information that you need, if you know, for instance, that your motion, that certain kinds of preposition take accusative case, certain kinds of prepositions take dative case, then you can figure out what case you're dealing with. But actually, even if you don't have that, you can still have a good guess on the basis of just this demonstrative form, feminine accusative. That's the structure here. And with may not seem like a motion preposition, but it kind of implies motion, right? Much as entlang in German, right? Is preposition, accusative case, it's because it's referring to a kind of spatial range, not just one location. All right, and this this whole text you can find on page 75 of the textbook, and just to practice this kind of knowledge using the paradigms, the crucial thing to do is to just try and read some texts, and if you find nouns, try and figure out what they are. Try and figure out if they're like feminine nouns or masculine nouns or neuter nouns. Try and figure out if they're dative case or genitive case or accusative case or nominative case. You've got all the paradigms you need to do it, so you don't here particularly have to memorize anything. What you have to do is understand how to use the paradigms. Does anyone have any questions? All right, so moving on then to the syntax of the language. It's not just the morphology that causes Old English to look radically different from present-day English. It's also the syntax. And the syntax of Old English, and forgive me for continually saying this, but it looks a bit like German, which is kind of helpful from one perspective, because where English differs from, where Old English differs from modern English, but where it's similar to German, it's a good clue that there's something going on and that something has changed in the history of English. And there are a few good sources for reading specifically about the syntax of the language. So this book by Fisher et al. From 2000, given in the references, chapter 2 gives a simple overview of the syntax of Old English. A very brief, readable overview. And for more detail, there's this book by Lawes, which talks about the historical syntax of English in general. That will also be a good introduction to some of this literature. So a few things here that are similar to German, just to give you the idea for what I mean when I keep saying this. So for a start, the WH question in English, in Old English, is formed with verb second. Verb second means that the finite verb is the second constituent in the clause. This is probably the single most crucial notion of Old English syntax, verb second. So here you've got verb second. How, hu lomp eo on lade? What happened to you on the trip? And you can see here that the verb, this is the verb here is lomp, happened, and it's second. English sometimes looks like it does this in subject questions, for instance, or with modals. What will you do? You've got subject-verb inversion. Will, the verb before the subject, you. In sentences like, what happened to you? The verb is second. The subject is what, and the verb is second. But this isn't a systematic property of modern English. Because if you take a modern English question like, for instance, if you want to say, you've got the declarative sentence, yesterday I ate a cake, and you want to ask a question, you don't, in modern English, you don't say what ate you yesterday, you have to say what did you eat. So you actually insert a special form. This is a dummy do, dummy or auxiliary or periphrastic do, it's sometimes referred to in the literature. It's a very special property of modern English. Don't find it at all in Old English. Instead, what you find is that the verb, the finite verb, just goes into the second position of the clause. And yes-no questions are formed with the finite verb first. So similarly, you just move the verb to the front of the sentence if you want to ask a question. You know, ate you a cake yesterday, rather than did you eat a cake yesterday? So this is a property, these two properties are shared entirely with languages like modern German, not only modern German, modern Dutch, the modern Scandinavian languages. It's a very typical Germanic property, later is lost to some extent in modern English. And we'll talk about that process of loss. But let's look also at something else. Remember that I said that nominative subjects are usually nominative, and nominative case is usually the subject. Where is the nominative case in a sentence like this? Well, there isn't one. There is no subject, as far as we can tell. This isn't a subject. That's just this is a WH adverb. How? It's just an adjunct. It can't be the subject. The verb doesn't agree with it, or anything like that. Ill is clearly dative case. It's an indirect object. What happened to you? And then here, down here, we've got a prepositional phrase. So we've got nothing in the nominative. Oh my goodness, we've got no subject in this sentence. Well, the old English speakers were perfectly fine with that. They didn't really care about whether you had a subject or not, especially when it's non-referential. So here, for instance, we've got a sentence without any kind of subject. Similarly, there are similar constructions in a language like German. You get something like mir ist kalt, where mir is dative case, and there's no nominative subject here. Right? There is no constituent in the nominative. Something like dann wurde getanzt, there is again no nominative subject. So this is possible in Old English, it's possible in German, not possible at all in Modern English. Modern English is a very specific language because it always, 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 always has to have a subject. And even when the subject doesn't really make any sense. So when you think of a sentence it is raining, right? It is raining. What is raining? Right? What is it that is raining? What does this it refer to? It doesn't refer to anything, okay? If you say it is raining, then there isn't any kind of it out there in the world to which this pronoun refers. So, but in English, nevertheless, you need to have this subject. Similarly, it seems. What seems? What is this it? What's it doing there? And the fact is, in English, this it is often only there because English is so keen to have a subject of the sentence that it sticks one in there even when it doesn't even mean anything. So English is a language that really, really likes subjects. Old English, German, bit more chilled out. No need for subjects. Now there is a circumstance in which these languages mostly do need subjects, and that is when it does refer to something or someone. But even these can be left out, and we'll see an example of this later on in the text. In fact, we'll see an example right now. Here are a few examples of the kind of structures that I've just been talking about. On the first top left here, we've got an example of a question. What sayest du? What do you say? Now, note the contrast there. In English, in modern English, what do you say? Right? The finite verb is do. In English, it's the verb say. It's inflected. It's got its usual inflection to agree with the subject, du. Was sagst du? Okay? But what's important here for our purposes today is that you've got the finite verb say before the subject. This is a structure that isn't possible in present-day English. Down here, similarly, is a yes-no question, and here the verb is the first constituent. Again, yihirastu, Eduacher. You've got hear you, literally, meaning do you hear, can you hear? But there's no need for an auxiliary. In modern English, you always need some kind of auxiliary, even dummy do, with a lexical verb. And then here are some examples that show you what I was talking about with regard to the subject. So if we start down here, Northan snuda. From the north, it snowed. It snowed in modern English with an it. Always this it, this subject that doesn't mean anything, but it has to be there. Old English, do without the subject. From the north, snowed. No subject. Easy. Okay? And now up here is an example of something that you see less often, but that still you do see. This is omitting the subject where the subject is referential, where it refers to something or someone. And here, the subject would be first person plural. So it would refer to us, we, us. And the structure here is nu shulen herian. This is from Cadman's hymn. Remember that this is the text that I talked about right at the start of last week's lecture. But this is a different version of the same text. This is actually a Northumbrian version of the text. And that might not be an accident. So we're dealing with a Northumbrian version of Cadman's hymn. In the West Saxon version, the we pronoun is present. In the Northumbrian version, the pronoun is completely absent. So there is, again, no subject here. But the difference between this one and this one is that here, you can leave the subject out because it's meaningless. Up here, the subject means something, but it's being left out anyway. That's rarer in Old English, but it does occur. Yes? Yeah. That is a complication. There are situations in German. It's not quite as simple as I've made out. You can actually think of three types of subject here. There are subjects that are referential. There are subjects that are completely non-referential, and there are subjects that are sort of somewhere in between, or at least you don't have to think of them like that. You can think of the weather verbs as being very particular. So why do you have es schneit, for instance, es regnet in German? And again, you do in that particular case, you do have to have the subject there. That's actually because I've oversimplified. Because I was saying that Old English is the same as German. Actually, the slight difference is, in that particular context with weather verbs, there are languages which have to have subjects as well, and actually German is one of those. Which is not really an explanation, but it's just a restatement of the facts. But there are different degrees to which languages are happy with leaving subjects out. In a language like English, you never leave the subject out. In a language like German, you mostly don't leave the subject out, but there are some circumstances where you can. So these are the sentences like, dann wurde getanzt, where you can. And languages like Old English, they're a bit more keen to leave the subject out. And then if you go even further towards the end of the spectrum, there are languages like Japanese, Chinese, also Italian, Spanish, Portuguese, where you can leave the subject out all over the place. So the phenomenon of leaving subject out of a sentence is much a little bit more complicated than what I presented at first. What's crucial to know is simply that Old English does it more than present-day English. Any other questions or thoughts? Okay, so let's dig a little bit deeper into this verb second, because it is, like I say, the verb second is the most important part of Old English syntax. Verb second is simply a requirement that the finite verb be preceded by only one constituent, and exactly one constituent. And what that means in practice is that if that first constituent is not the subject, then you have to have the subject after the verb, because you have then you have inversion. So here you've got the subject following the verb. So there, we've seen some examples of this already in WH questions. So questions that begin with when, why, what, how, or who. These questions, or which, these questions are always verb second in Old English. Main clauses, it's a bit more complicated. In main clauses, you usually get verb second. But there are exceptions. And the main exception is that if you have elements that are old information in the discourse, they can precede the verb. I'll give you an example of this soon. Typically, these are subject pronouns. So typically, subject pronouns can escape verb second, and then you have two constituents before the finite verb. And even actually with this caveat, there is still a verb second is not an absolute rule in Old English. It seems to be more of a tendency. So you can measure the amount of verb second in Old English using corpora, using collections of texts that you can analyze quantitatively, and then you find that some percentage of clauses just fail to show verb second for reasons that aren't very well understood. If you know some German, you can use your knowledge here. Think about a sentence. Think about whether it would be the same in modern English. If your sentence, your Old English sentence, is the same as German, but different from Old English, that probably indicates that there's something interesting going on, that there's something that's changed in the history of English, something that's worth pointing out, something that's worth talking about. Verb second is one of these things, because verb second in German is pretty much absolute, pretty much. So here's the examples. So here's a very straightforward one. This one translates into Old English, into modern English, very straightforwardly. Du hast your koren von aware. You have chosen that man. So you've got a verb second clause, because you've got the subject, du, then you've got the verb, havast. And so you're dealing with a verb second clause that's also subject initial. But this one isn't very exciting, because it wouldn't behave any differently in modern English. This is the kind of thing, on the other hand, this second example is the crucial one, because this second example is the example where Old English and Modern English behave differently. On tham daya, wachte God lecht. On that day, God created light. In Modern English, you have to translate it with the verb after the subject. In Old English, the verb comes before the subject. The verb wachte, worked or created, has to precede the subject, God, in this kind of example. So that's what the second example is showing. That's verb second in Old English. This third example then, here we've got a third example, mar an kule ich jeser. And this example is one that also you can translate into Old English, a greater cold I saw. But here you've got an exception to verb second. And it's an exception to verb second because it falls into that category that I told about, old discourse information, someone who's been mentioned before in the discourse. In the context here, we've got a subject pronoun. This is a known entity in the discourse. And that means that this subject pronoun comes before the verb in this instance. Subject, this is almost exceptionless with subject pronouns. They precede. So I saw a greater cold. This is an example from Alfrich's Catholic Homilies. And it's not restricted to pronouns. Sometimes you will find in the literature suggestions that this behavior is only found with pronouns. That's not the case. So you also found it. You also find it here with examples like this. Thana, that one. Or this one. Sigedwert, the gate guard, the gate ward, lets in. Again, finite verb, second position, not second position, sorry. I keep saying the exact opposite of what I mean today. This is really not helpful. Third position, the verb is in third position, hence the number three, which is written in a large font over here. The verb is in third position, and what comes between the verb and the first constituent is the subject. Segedwert. And again, in context, in the discourse, this is old information, and hence it can precede the subject. What we don't find preceding precede the verb, it can precede the verb, not the subject. Sorry. Right, I'll go and self-flagellate about this later, but this is all good. All right, so this is an example from the West Saxon Gospels in which the subject precedes the verb. This is an exception to the verb second tendency, the very strong, robust verb second tendency that is illustrated by examples like this. Is that clear? Probably not very, but the tutors can sort it out later on. That's their job. Excellent. All right. So that's the basic, the most important syntactic feature of Old English. The Old English has verb seconds a lot of the time, but it also has some other special syntactic features that you find quite a lot. One of them is that the finite verb is often, the non-finite verb is often clause final. This is a feature that Old English shares with German that it doesn't share with languages like modern-day English. So Old English, if you abstract away from the verb second rule, Old English shows a very strong tendency to be object-verb. The object comes before the verb. So that is a very basic syntactic feature of Old English. Let's see if we've got any examples of this on an earlier slide. No. Why do we have to go all the way back to here, right? Subordinate clause. Now remember, verb second is something we find in main clauses, and this is the same in German, again, broadly speaking. So here you've got a clause that he, of all Northmen, lived the northmost. And the verb, lived, Bude, comes right at the end of the clause. So you've got the verb right at the end here, where the clause starts all the way over here, and you've got three whole constituents before the verb. And so, again, the tendency, and it is only a tendency in Old English, is for verbs to be final in subordinate clauses. Similarly, non-finite verbs, I think I've got an example of that later on, will often be clause final, though they're not always. Here is another special feature of English. How do you negate a sentence? Negating a sentence is very simple in Old English. There is a special particle, ne or ni, and this ni, you just stick it in front of the finite verb. And it doesn't count as a constituent, it's a prefix, so it just slots in there and it negates the whole sentence. So here you've got an example, ne kom he. He didn't come. This ne is how you do negation. That changes, obviously, because in modern English you negate things with a not or n't. And now the change that happens in negation in the history of English is one of the most interesting changes of all. And we're going to talk about that later on in the course. But for now, the key thing is just Old English negation is ne. And that's not complicated. There are no nasty exceptions or anything like that. It's just ne, always. One thing that you find quite a lot in Old English, it's just very characteristic of the prose of Old English, is these correlative constructions. So here you've got a clause, when tha, I remembered all this, and then the main clause is introduced by a tha. So when blah, 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 then, and this is something that you also find in English, you only find it in one situation. In modern day English, you find it with if and then, right? So if such and such happens, then, and that then is optional, you know. If you come to the party wearing that hat, then I will disown you. If you come to the party wearing that hat, I will disown you, right? Means the same thing. But the then is a resumptive. It picks up on what's been said before. And that's what this tha is doing here. This tha is picking up on this whole clause. When I remembered all of this, then... And this is something that we see quite often in Old English. Not only with temporal clauses like this. We see it in examples like, where such and such happens, there you will find... So you've got these pairs. And these correlative constructions are just something that you see an awful lot of in Old English texts. So here we go. When I all of this remembered, so this is a nice final verb, then wondered I terribly much of the wise men. Now, going back a little bit to the start of the lecture, check out these beautiful genitive plural case endings. Isn't that a work of art? They're glorious. ENA, right? They can only mean one thing. Genitive plural, ladies and gentlemen. Right, so here are some examples from Ohtere again. We're picking up on Ohtere's story. Tha was he swa fer north, swa da chwal hunten firest farath. Then he was so far north as the whale hunters go. So he's going as far north as the whale hunters. And so here you've got V2, you've got inversion, you've got was he, and then... you've got, so you remember here you've got the verb and then you've got the subject. So this is a verb second clause. Down here you've got a non-verb second clause. It starts here, as far north as the whale hunters furthest go. And the verb is right at the end, farath. Farath, this is from the verb faran, which is cognate with modern German fahren, another verb that is lost in the history of English. Or at least, not lost entirely. It's maintained, but it's maintained in some very specific and little odd constructions. So for instance, an archaic way of saying goodbye is to say farewell. Farewell. This fair comes from this verb fahren, which is cognate with German fahren. So it means literally travel well. Go well, originally. And it's still possible to say something is, a situation is, a person is faring poorly, faring badly. If you're losing in a competition, it means you're, you know, you can say you're faring badly. This faring, again, is a is cognate with German fahren, and it is related there. But it has a change in meaning, as many, many words do in the history of English. In fact, this is what we're going to come on to in just a couple of seconds. But let me finish off with this slide, because we've got another example of fahren here for the finite past form, for, and again, inversion. Then travelled he, thayit, nordrichter. Then travelled he even further north. This guy really likes travelling north, okay? So Ohtere has gone really far north, but the important point is verb second. There is inversion. The verb precedes the subject in these cases in a main clause, in an unembedded clause, and in subordinate clauses, the verb can be found later. Any questions? This is not something that you will need to know for the exam. You won't have to do any trees or anything related to trees. But if you're interested, this is how you would do something like Old English verb second and Old English OV in a syntactic tree of the kind that you would cover in a course like Shi Wan. The crucial position here is CP, the clausal phrase, and you can think of verb second as a requirement that a clause have a CP necessarily, and that CP has something in its specifier, something here, and something in its head position here. Because there is only one CP, that means that your constituent, your pre-verbal constituent, is always in this spec CP slot. There's only one slot, so that's why you get verb second. And the verb goes into this head position here, this C head. And as for OV, you can deal with that by saying that unlike modern English, the verb phrase is not head initial, but head final. You just flip things round. You take the object and the verb. In modern English, they'd be in the opposite order, and you just flip them round and to get the Old English order. And for that matter, the standard German order. And this is what you would think of as the normal structure, the sort of default structure for Old English main clauses. You've got the finite verb in the C position and a VP that is head final. Like I said, if you're not familiar with this kind of tree or you don't like this kind of tree, don't worry about it because we're not going to talk about it for the exam for this course. But I thought you might like to see how it related to other stuff that you've studied if you've taken modules which cover syntactic theory. So let's wrap up the grammar part then, and let's move on to other things. So the morphology, this is what we covered last week. We've got an elaborate pronominal system. We've got no distinct definite articles, only demonstratives. But the demonstratives can often function as definite articles. So there is no word, the modern English the and a, an, have not fully developed yet. So that you get those. Nouns have gender. Nouns can receive case inflections. And this is something that modern English does not do at all, but which modern German does do. Adjectives agree with nouns. They can be weak or strong. Remember that the crucial thing with adjectives that determines whether they're weak or strong is whether they occur with the demonstrative or something like the demonstrative. So if they occur with the demonstrative, then you get a weak adjective. If not, you get a strong adjective. Verbs, then, are marked for subject, person, and a number, and they have endings that represent the person and number of the clause, and the verbs can also be weak or strong. But verbs are inherently weak or strong. It's not a property of the context like it is for adjectives. So that's the morphology. We covered the basics of that last week. The syntax then, again, as I've said, the things to look out for, the particularly Old English features that set it apart from the present day language, are verb second and OV. You don't always find them, but when you do find them, it's interesting. And you might well get a question that's something like, here's a little bit of Old English text with glosses, spot the object verb order. For example, that's the kind of thing you might in principle be asked. Old English can leave subjects out. This is something I spent a while illustrating. Mostly, it's the non-referential subjects that get left out, the ones that to a first approximation don't mean anything. Old English doesn't use auxiliaries very much. It certainly doesn't use do as an auxiliary like the present day language does. It has a negation, it has a particle ne that comes before the verb, and it has frequent use of correlative constructions. Those are the key properties that we've covered today. Any questions before we leave Old English grammar behind? Well, before I leave Old English grammar behind, you will still have to focus on it, at least in the tutorial, but I get to move on to different things. Now then, we're going to talk about words and the meaning of words. So moving on from the structure of the language as a whole, we can talk about individual words and the trajectories of individual words. And as you can see from a slide like this, individual word trajectories can be very, very strange. It's very difficult to discern patterns in some of these trajectories. But talking about the Old English lexicon in general for a start, remember at the start of the course that we talked about the fact about modern English that's very interesting, which is that so much of the modern English lexicon is of foreign origin. It comes from Latin, it comes from Greek, it comes from French, it comes from Scandinavian, seemingly anywhere other than West Germanic. That's not true for Old English. Old English is very, very Germanic in its vocabulary. It's been estimated that the non-Germanic component of Old English is only about 3%. That's very striking when you compare it to some of the estimates that we saw in the first lecture for modern English, where if you take the whole of the English vocabulary, the present-day English vocabulary, the majority of it is non-Germanic. So that's a huge shift that's taken place in the history of the language. And we want to know why, of course, and one of the things we're going to talk about quite a lot next week is exactly why. The language is the external influences on English. But it's been estimated that 80% of the original vocabulary of Old English has been lost in the history of the language. Now, Old English does something that German and Dutch and Scandinavian languages also do, which is to form new words via a process of compounding. It does this very productively and all over the place. So here's one of my favorite Old English words, word hoard. Word hoard. This is a collection of words, a whole load of words, a hoard of words. In other words, a vocabulary. So in Beowulf, for instance, in the epic poem Beowulf, the lead character is not just a big, tough man. He also has a magnificent vocabulary, right? And he shows off his vocabulary on occasion. So if you read Beowulf, you will be impressed by how good he is as a talker as well as a fighter. He can really do it all. He's a paradigm example of a human being. So that's one example, word hoard, but this process where you just add hoard onto the end is very productive. So here you've got moord hoard. You can translate this directly as something like mood hoard, but this moord in Old English has a much broader meaning. It means something like spirit or mind, right? And in this case, a spirit hoard, a mind hoard, just means secret thoughts, things that you're hoarding for yourself inside your head. Maud also comes into all kinds of compounds. So maud caru is mood care, or in other words, sorrow. This is it means that you're unhappy. And here, maud crafty. Mood crafty or mood strong, usually this crafty, which corresponds to modern English crafty and modern German kräftig. Both of these have undergone semantic development, meaning development in different directions. So where kräftig in German usually means something like big or heavy, crafty in English means sort of cunning or sort of even a little bit tricksy. But in Old English, kräftig really means strong. And moord kräftig just means mind strong, in other words, intelligent. So this is the kind of word that we find in Old English all over the place, these compound words, where you get bits of words, you chop them up, and you add them together and make new words. Interestingly, names in Old English, are often compounds as well. So King Alfred, for instance, Alfred the Great, he of the Wessex writing Renaissance in Old English in the 9th century, his name means Alf, which is elf, red. Red is like German Rat. It means, in this case, advice or counsel. So this Alfred means elf advice. And if you're interested in the Anglo-Saxons quite liked to talk about elves, and there is some work on what elf actually means in the Old English tradition, what it actually refers to. If anyone is interested in that, I can pass on the details. But this elf meaning component is something that you actually see quite a lot. Similarly, Hrothgar. Hrothgar is the king that you find in Beowulf. He's the king who Beowulf comes to help out. Hrothgar's having trouble, and Beowulf comes to save his bacon. But Hrothgar's name means wrath spear, angry spear. And then Athelstan, this is a king, a later king of the Anglo-Saxons. His name means noble stone. This is directly cognate with the German Edelstein. So Athelstan is Edelstein, noble stone. And that's what these names often have this compound structure, the Old English names. They don't always. So for instance, an example of a name that doesn't have a compound structure is wolf, which just means wolf. And that is also found. But a lot of the names are indeed this more complex structure. What about borrowings then? Well, I've said that only 3% of the words in Old English are non-Germanic. We can start, in fact, with Norse, because Norse words are Germanic. Remember that the Vikings, the Scandinavians, were Germanic speakers. They were speakers of North Germanic rather than West Germanic. And we can find out about the Norse. The Old English talk about the Norse in their written text, and that's why we know that from the mid-9th century, Viking invasions or settlements became quite common, particularly from 793, where the Vikings attacked the monastery of Lindisfarne in the northeast. You then, after that, you get Vikings coming and staying and settling in England. But the early loans from Norse relate to things that the Norse are very good at. So the Norse, they come over there in their boats, and they invade, and they make settlements. But they are very, very good with boats. Very, very good with boats. And therefore, words for things to do with boats are often borrowed from Norse. So, for instance, havener, a harbour, or haven, this is a word that's borrowed in Old English from Norse. Similarly, words relating to law, because one thing that is less associated with the Vikings, but also a very, very important, well, it's less associated with them in the popular imagination, but it's also a very important characteristic of the Vikings, is that they had a very well-developed legal system. They had laws, and the word for law in English, in modern English, comes from the Scandinavian word. So, lagu, this word for law, comes from Scandinavia originally, comes from the Vikings. So there are some words, not very many words, but some, that come from Norse into Old English. These are typical prestige-driven loans. They're words for things that the Vikings were very good at. So that's the Germanic loan words, but still most of the Germanic words come from Old English itself. Outside Germanic, and remember we're dealing with a tiny proportion of words here, here we're talking about Latin and Celtic. Latin is where most of our loan words come from. We have to be a little bit careful about this, because remember that the written texts that we have in Old English are largely written by monks. They are, in fact, exclusively written in a monastic context, and that means that these words, that these texts, are not representative of the whole population. So in the texts that we see a fair number of Latin loanwords, but that doesn't mean that these were words that people were widely using in day-to-day life. In fact, often they're very clearly not. There are very, very early loanwords into Old English from Latin. So Latin and Germanic have been in contact since long, long before the Germanic tribes ever came to the British Isles. So the really, really early loanwords in Latin, they are borrowed so early that they actually show some of the same changes that we see in early Old English that distinguishes Old English from the other Germanic languages. So for instance, in early Latin, the word castra, a military camp, is borrowed into Germanic. So they take the Latin word castra into Germanic. What's interesting there is that this word undergoes palatalization. Remember palatalization, a k can become a ch, and this is an instance of that. It becomes Chester. And this Chester is found in a lot of English place names. You get Winchester, the capital of King Alfred, you get Manchester, you get Leicester. That's a little bit more complicated, but it comes from something like Leicester, and it just turns into Leicester. But there are many of these places that end in Chester. And if you've ever wondered where these place names come from, this is where they come from. They come from these Germanic, this word for a military camp, the military camp of Man, or the military camp of Win. So Chester originally means military camp. Those are the early Latin loanwords, and the late Latin loanwords, we see quite a lot of those too. We see words that reflect the influence of the church. Words for bishops and priests and particular religious services. These, again, might have been words that were in common use in Anglo-Saxon England, or they might not have been. We don't really know how religious the majority of the population was, or how Christian the majority of the population was. Because recall that when the Anglo-Saxons arrived in the British Isles, they were not Christian. They got Christianized later. So, and with the Christianization came an influx of Latin vocabulary. So that's the Latin. Yes?
Are there any kind of like depictions of dialogue in the Old English corpus so that basically, although it was written off by priests and things like that, they ever kind of depict the speech or describe the speech more directly of other groups that were speaking Old English?
So the question is, are there any depictions of dialogue or the speech of other groups? And the answer is very rarely. So one text that I briefly showed you at the end of last lecture, Alfred's Colloquy, has this kind of little artificial dialogue. But that actually we have to take with some pinch of salt because it's a translation from Latin. So real genuine dialogue in these texts is quite hard to find. Possibly the best place to look is somewhere like Beowulf, actually, where you have a kind of narrative with characters interacting with one another. Or for instance, Apollonius of Tyre. That's another text which has some dialogue in it. And often, usually the characters described are not monastic, but the people who are writing the texts are. And so we're never quite clear of this kind of, ecclesiastical influence on the Old English texts. And then when it comes to the Celtic influence, we don't actually find enormously much. This is one of the mysteries of English historical linguistics. Given that when the Anglo-Saxons arrived, the Anglo-Saxons were not hugely many, and they arrived, and there must have been Celtic speakers already there, why didn't English borrow more words from Celtic? Well, one obvious answer was that the Celtic languages were not very prestigious in Anglo-Saxon England, and that might be behind some of this reluctance to borrow words, because mostly word borrowing is prestige-based. You borrow a word from a language which has a high status. Just about one of the few words that we can say with certainty is borrowed from Celtic is this word, broch, meaning a badger, this guy. What do we call it? What's the German word for one of these? Dachs. Okay. So a Dachshund is a badger dog? Oh, that's really cool. Okay. I've learned something. I'm happy. All right. Does anyone have any questions? No? Okay. Well, those are the loan words then in Old English. And next week, we're going to talk in much more detail about those external influences on the English language, with particular reference to the transition between Old and Middle English. Meaning change, though, we have to mention briefly, because this is quite important. Words change, and words change their meaning in many, many different ways. I gave you a whole range of examples that you can try and interpret and understand in your own time on the first slide of this section. But you can see some of these already straightforwardly. Often, words narrow in their meaning over time. So the Old English word mord, which I talked about earlier on, in compounds like mordhord and mordkrafti, this word originally means something like spirit or heart or mind or soul, even, depending on how you want to interpret it. And in modern English, it comes to just mean mood, which is a much narrower notion. Similarly, Old English deor, which means animal, this is cognate with German Tier, right? So deor originally means animal. It becomes to mean deer, specifically deer, which is a certain kind of animal, what's the German word? Is it Reh? Is that, no. These guys with horns that kind of scamper around the place. They're wonderful animals. Oh God, that's just been videoed, hasn't it? Okay. Maybe we can cut that bit out. Don't cut it out. all right. So those are that's is deer. Old English Hund. Old English Hund means dog, just like German Hund. And it comes to mean hound, right? A hound. And a hound in modern English is a very specific kind of dog. It's the kind of dog that you use to go hunting with, for instance, if you're a member of the Conservative Party. Those are instances of narrowing. A word with a broad meaning comes to have a narrower meaning. But we also see the opposite. So English, Old English, bairn, a barn, originally it meant specifically a place where you store barley. You don't store anything else there, you store barley in your bairn and nothing else. Nowadays, you can use barns for all kinds of things. You can put a cow in a barn, you can put, you know, apples or potatoes or whatever you like. It's just a big, big space that's on a farm that you use to put stuff in. So words can widen in meaning as well. There can also be metaphorical instances of meaning change. For instance, a crane, we've got a crane here, it's a bird, and you also get this mechanical device that you use for constructing buildings, you can lift things up with it, and it's big and metal, and that is also called a crane, because I guess it looks a little bit like this guy, right? It's got a long, thin neck and a long bit that comes out. So that's a crane, and that's a sort of metaphorical extension. This we see a lot. Similarly, to grasp. Originally, the original meaning of grasp was a physical action. So you grasp something. I grasp the hat, okay? But grasp in the modern language can also mean to understand. And this is a sort of metaphorical use. It means you're reaching out with your mind to a new idea and you are grasping it. So if you say, I haven't quite grasped Old English syntax, right? Old English syntax is not something that you can physically grasp, but it is something that you can understand. Trust me on that. So in this word grasp over the history of English has come to mean understand. This is often a trajectory of meaning change. Terms, concrete things, concrete ideas, concrete concepts get translated into the abstract domain as a process of meaning change. You also get changes of connotation. So here we've got Old English salig, meaning blessed. This is like the German word selig. And this word comes to mean silly, right? Which is more like, I don't know, albern or something. So this is the German word, this is the English word for silly, which goes from this very positive meaning to this relatively negative meaning. Old English Knecht means a youth or a servant. Again, German Knecht for comparison. Modern English Knight with a K, that has a very positive meaning. It's these guys in shining armor that ride around doing daring deeds and rescuing damsels in distress from dragons and that kind of thing. So that's very different from a Knecht, which is a much lower status occupation. So words can get more negative in their meaning, but they can also get more positive. And if you're interested in this kind of meaning change, there's all kinds of mileage you can get out of it. It's really kind of fun. You can explore the Old English Dictionary on the Oxford English Dictionary online and look at the meanings of different words and how they've changed over time. It's very difficult to make good generalizations about meaning change. One I've already mentioned, which is that the concrete domain is often used to conceptualize abstract domains, and that is a common pathway of meaning change. This is a fascinating area that we won't be able to do full justice to on a course like this. Finally then, and quite briefly, the dialects of Old English. Now here I've given you a map of Old England in around 600. So in around 600, you've got, these are the tribes that settled, right? You've got your Saxons down here in the brown, you've got your Angles who come to be the basis of the Mercians, also in the Northumbrians largely, and then you've got your yellow here is the Jutes who settle in Kent and around the Isle of Wight. And in these grey areas, around 600, we would still have had a largely Celtic-speaking population of Britons. What does this mean when it comes to the dialects then? Well, this is kind of dangerous because the thing about Old English dialects is that they're not really dialects in the traditional sense. As soon as you think of dialects, you think of a map. You think of where people speak in what way. But the problem with the Old English dialects is that what they really refer to is groups of texts with similar linguistic features. As Campbell puts it, it's not possible to draw a dialect map of England in the Old English period. I'll show you why in a minute. But what's crucial is that almost exclusively linguistic criteria are used to find out, to assign texts to dialects. So when we talk about these dialects of Old English, what we really mean is different types of language, different types of text, with different linguistic features that group together. Having said that, we can divide these dialects into these traditional groups, which more or less correspond to the sort of tribes that were settling. So Kentish, remember the Jutes settled in Kent, the Kentish dialect of Old English, not very well attested, but quite distinct phonologically. West Saxon is the big one. We have more West Saxon than anything else. We have more West Saxon than all of the others put together, easily. And then we've got two dialects that belong together, And they are the Anglian dialects and the Anglian dialects, which means Mercian and Northumbrian. These names correspond to the traditional kingdoms. So here we've got the kingdoms of Northumbria and Mercia, which are most strongly associated with the Angles. That's these tribes up here, right? These kingdoms of Northumbria and Mercia that we talked about in the earlier lectures. That's broadly who these dialects are associated with. But what we actually have is something much, much narrower. We know where some of these texts were produced on physical grounds. We can figure out where the manuscripts came from. Sometimes the manuscripts mention where they came from. And then there are other texts which we don't have the evidence for, but where we can group together texts that have similar linguistic behavior. So when we talk about Northumbrian, for instance, we're talking about a collection of texts, particularly the Lindisfarne Gospels. Remember the beautiful illustrated manuscript I showed you last time, the illuminated manuscript. That's the front page, one of the front pages of the Lindisfarne Gospels. And these texts, we know, were produced in a monastic context up here, Chesterless Street, near present-day Durham. So those are the Northumbrian texts, and we assign them to a dialect, even though all we really know is that some of these texts were produced in this particular place, and some of these texts look like these other texts. We also find Mercian texts. We know that some of these were produced in Lichfield. Now it's a fairly insignificant town in England, but back in the Mercian period it was a very, very important place indeed. The Vespasian Psalter, we can locate to Lichfield. And then these two other texts, the Epinal Glossary and the Corpus Glossary, we can say, well, they're very similar to the texts that we know were produced in Lichfield, so we can assign them to the same dialect, to the Mercian dialect. The Kentish Glosses, we happen to know that these were produced in Canterbury, down here. So again, we know where they're from, and we know where similar texts are from. And then early West Saxon, we know that those were from the Winchester area. So some of these texts we can locate quite precisely, others much less so. To give you a very brief example of the kind of thing we see when we compare different texts, here we're lucky enough to have two different versions of the same text. This is the Northumbrian Cadman's Hymn, and this is the West Saxon version of the same text. You'll note a few differences immediately. So this is the one we talked about earlier on, subject pronoun. The subject pronoun is there in the West Saxon, we. There's nothing there in the Northumbrian, nothing at all. So that's one difference. Another difference is regarding the sound change breaking that we talked about last time. This is a sound change that West Saxon has much more robustly than Northumbrian. So in the word weart, guard or warden, we find ea here, breaking, because remember you've got an R and then a consonant. That's the environment for breaking as a sound change. And then here in the Northumbrian, you've just got ward. So that's another one of these differences between these texts. Another example of that is down here, werk here versus weork up here. So another example of the absence of breaking. I'll leave you to read through the summary for yourself because it doesn't say anything new. In time for the tutorial, what I'd like you to do is have a go at exercise 5 in the textbook, which is very quick, and also to look at the chronicle text that you can find in Elias. This is Old English Text 2, and focus in particular on the grammar, on the syntactic structure of this text. And I will see you again next week for the lecture on the transition to Middle English.